You're listening to Discordia, over 50 years of student activism at Concordia University. On CJLO 1690 AM or online at cjlo.com.
My name's Piper, and I'm an independent artist, musician, and academic invested in researching alternative modes of storytelling. I live, work, and create within the unceded lands currently known as Montreal, and I'm currently enjoying engaging in forms of education and knowledge sharing situated outside of the academy after completing my master's thesis here at Concordia in spring of 2024. My background in campus community radio spans over a decade across several stations, and I'm very pleased to be here at CJLO, co-producing Discordia for you.
I'm Sydney. I'm originally from Cataraqui or Kingston and have been living in Jojage since 2010. I recently finished a PhD in interdisciplinary humanities at Concordia on the rise of magic, astrology, and related occult practices as resources for community building and political work in Montreal. I've done talk radio on antennas and CKUT, and I think of radio as a perfect methodology and companion to community-based research and activism. I'm looking forward to delving into the archives, making connections with other activists, and finding through lines in student solidarity movements in Montreal over the last half century.
The years 1999 to 2000 marked a significant shift in student governance at Concordia University. In this second episode of the docuseries Discordia, we look at what has been identified by some observers as the early forms of anti-austerity and anti-corporatization that will continue to mark student activism at the school for the next 25 years.
The CSU, or Concordia Student Union, eventually succeeded in becoming accredited as the sole association legally representing all undergraduate students. And we will explore some of the major concerns that drove this particularly high voter turnout and student engagement with student politics.
In March 1998, Concordia undergraduate students voted to join the Canadian Federation of Students, or the CFS. The CFS provides students from across the country with an effective and united voice, provincially and nationally, beyond the abilities of any individual student union.
This occurs in January 1999. While the CSU rallies students to vote in the first referendum attempt for accreditation, set for the last 2 weeks of February. This referendum fails due to low voter turnout, failing to make quorum, the minimum number of members necessary to constitute a valid representation of a group, in this case, Concordia undergraduate students.
The chief electoral officer, Lindsay Scully, said she was puzzled and upset by the voter apathy. She says, "What does it take to get people at this university to turn around and care? I think part of the problem is that people don't realize the role that the CSU plays in their lives on a day-to-day basis." But this is hardly the end of the fight for CSU accreditation. On April 1st, 1999, Rob Green is elected president of the CSU.
Hello.
Hi, is this Robert?
It is.
This is Robert Green, who spoke with me about his time as CSU president, the legacy of accreditation, and the power of student activism in Montreal.
So my name is Robert Green, and I was doing my undergraduate at Concordia in the late 90s, and I was first the vice president of administration in the Concordia Student Union in the 98-99 school year. I did run to be president for the 1999-2000 school year, and then I was re-elected in 2000-2001.
Okay, so what is accreditation, though? Like, wasn't there already a student union at Concordia?
So yeah, from my understanding, there's been a Concordia University Students Association since 1979, and this eventually became CSU. It was first CUSA, and it has reps from all the faculties that are proportionate to the student population in each. So there's arts and science, commerce, fine arts, engineering, computer science, and independent students. And all these students enjoy the rights of membership, which include voting, holding office, and using the services, which at this time included the Reggie's Bar, the Mez Cafe, service centers at Loyola and downtown campus, as well as photocopying and fax services, the Job and Housing Bank, the health plan, the computer lab, and the Hive. And accreditation would provide recognition that the CSU was the sole representative voice of students, which guaranteed them space and representation on university committees and access to information, among others. For example, David Smaller, who was the president of CSU in 1999, says that accreditation was implemented implemented to protect and enhance the role of students in the democratic development of universities. It will actually legally recognize a relationship that already exists within the university. So they're already providing these services. It's just that they're not actually really legally representing all of the students that are, you know, benefactors of them.
It is problematic for the student union to be advocating for anything with the administration when the administration can turn around and say, you're not the representative of all students, and can have, you know, these dissenting faculty associations coming in and saying, we see it a different way.
So the Student Associations Act, or Law 32, was negotiated between students and the Quebec provincial government in 1983.
Quebec is unique, as far as I know, in Canada, in having legislation that actually protects the rights of student unions. For example, once a student union is accredited with the government, the university must collect the fees as decided by students in referendum and transfer that to the student union. There's also guarantees that the student union will have access to space for their offices, access to bulletin boards to communicate with members, you know, the sort of basic things that you would need in order to have a student union.
So this is interesting because it means that while they were part of the institution, being granted accreditation under Law 32 actually would give them a considerable amount of bargaining power, because it was a kind of contract with the province that went above the administration and gave them a kind of special status that wouldn't exist just in terms of their membership as a student at Concordia at the time.
So accreditation meant the CSU would be recognized under provincial law as the official voice of the entire undergraduate student body. But in order to win the accreditation drive, the CSU needed a majority of the undergraduate student body to vote yes.
Right. So the argument of CSU is that they actually already take care of students. They just aren't necessarily recognized for it. And crucially, there's a kind of competing membership happening, because there were already two student associations that have been accredited to represent their members. And that's Commerce and Administrative Student Association and the Engineering and Comp Sci Students, or ECA. And the problem was that all of these students actually benefit from CSU programming and services, but they only pay into their own membership. So there's this kind of incongruent thing happening, and accreditation would sort of iron that out. I think at the time, everyone paid $2, and CSU was providing services for about 24,000 students that actually only 17,000 students were paying for because of this disparate faculty accreditation. And getting accreditation would unite all the undergrads under this equal footing and clarify the relationship between all the different student associations that still would have the right to exist and, you know, serve their own constituents as they saw fit.
Right. So then the CSU would start collecting student fees from all full-time undergraduates.
So the first attempt to accredit happened under the David Smaller administration in 98-99, and it was unsuccessful. And the reason why it was unsuccessful is that, according to the legislation, there's a very, very high bar for the level of participation. Half of the students had to vote in the election or the referendum to accredit. Otherwise, it would not be valid. And voter turnout is historically been a challenge at Concordia in student union elections and whatnot. And that was the reason why it failed the first time. Like, the majority of those that voted yes for it, but they didn't have that 50% turnout. And so when we were looking into this, like after I got elected as president, we met with, there's a government agent, a bureaucrat that works for the Quebec government, who oversees the file of student unions accrediting. And we had a meeting with him, and he explained that actually one of the things that we could do to ensure the voter turnout, or at least the hope for a better voter turnout, was to have mobile polling stations that actually go into classes. Well, and the professors were obliged to allow a statement to be said about what is accreditation, mm-hmm. and then a vote would be held right in the class. So that gave us a lot of hope, and then it was just a matter for us to organize the logistics of having mobile polling stations that went into every single undergraduate class at Concordia and have people vote. That's, you know, essentially how we were able to win that referendum to have the student union accredited.
Okay, so it's October 2000, and the second referendum attempt succeeds with a vote of 66% and the CSU gains provincial accreditation. But a lot happens between the first rumblings of the accreditation in fall 1999 and its success in 2000, a year later. With the election of Rob Green, a lot of different issues start coming to the forefront that most likely were partly responsible for galvanizing students to eventually push for accreditation and actually turn out to vote.
You know, this was not our first campaign, the accreditation drive. We came in with a very strong activist agenda, and, you know, there was a number of issues in my first term. So, for example, one of our first campaigns was about Marriott Sodexo, and I'll just say that these early campaigns is what I think was a big factor in sort of sparking people's interest that there is a student union and that it's doing things to advance our interests and that sort of thing.
In the Thursday report published September 9, 1999, Barbara Black describes Green as a student activist of long standing who believes that tuition should be paid entirely by the state and free from what he perceives as creeping corporatization. Green has often taken to the streets to back up his beliefs. You can expect more calls for demonstrations and student strikes while he's president, says Black.
Under this first presidential term of Rob Green, a referendum regarding a strike garnered 2,284 votes of support, an impressively high vote from Concordia students. The strike lasted from November 3rd to 5th and targeted a range of issues, which included student representation in the University Senate, the issue of corporate presence on campus and advertising, and governance in general. During this November strike, there were several demonstrations where both protesters and police were reported to be injured.
There's a photo here of Rob Green dressed as a clown at a protest, presumably that November protest. His face is painted green and purple, and he's wearing a classic red clown nose, which is very Montreal, and smiling as he leans on a placard I can't quite make out. But it says Arrête, or stop, in large lettering.
This began an era of student protest against big business on campus and an anti-austerity mindset that we see continuing in student protests today at Concordia.
In my experiences in Quebec was that there was sort of a cultural dimension to student activism here that, you know, young Quebecois students all knew about the process of student strikes. And even if they had not been involved in one, they had an older brother or sister or an older cousin that had been involved. And, you know, there was, through those strike movements, just this remarkable culture of direct democracy.
Despite a freeze on tuition that's regulated by the province, some were calling the increases that the university demanded a backdoor tuition hike or a kind of sneaky tuition hike, meaning that the fees were simply going to pad the administration rather than actually covering changes in the cost of services for students.
So the other major issue at that time was something called the administration fee. So, you know, you're aware, I'm sure, that tuition is regulated in Quebec, thanks to the fact that Quebec historically has had a very, very strong student movement, that at that time, I think there had been six general unlimited student strikes, I think, and then 2012 out of the seventh, if I'm not mistaken, that, you know, fought against tuition increases and succeeded, I think, almost every time. And so we saw this administration fee, and so we took the position that this was a backdoor tuition increase because it wasn't for anything. Our position was like, that's not a fee you're paying for something, that's tuition. to fund the university. So we demanded also in that referendum the cancellation of the administration fee. So following the by-election where we took these things to the referendum, close to about 90% of students were voting in, of those that voted, you know, were voting in favor of our demand. So with that, we then had the mandate to organize the general meeting. And that also, I'll say, was a major challenge because the quorum for a general meeting, if I'm not mistaken, was around 600 students. Like, you pretty much had to fill H110 in order for the vote to count. And so we went to work doing weeks and weeks of class visits, mobilizing for that general meeting. We succeeded in getting quorum for that general meeting, and then we passed a strike vote. After we had the general meeting and the strike began, during the strike, we both picketed, but we also occupied the senior administration offices that were at that time in Bishop's Court, and the administration then agreed to negotiations with us.
two motions proposed by the student senators were passed. One ensured that students who took part in the strike would not suffer academically, and the other supported the students' call for restoration of the nearly $2 billion in cuts to Quebec universities. Several other resolutions were tabled for a future meeting.
And so just to zero in on one of the main issues that the student union was grappling with and which the strike was meant to bring attention to was that there was an exclusive food services contract that was enjoyed by Marriott, and his contract was with Concordia. And Senator Blaze, who was a student senator in 1999, alleged that it restricts the variety of food that is offered to students and prevents groups from serving their own food at special events. And there are such exorbitant charges as, for example, $25 for a pitcher of water for a speaker who's invited. The vice rector of services, Charles Emond, explained that Marriott remits a substantial portion of its sales to the university. So this was his excuse for why they have this contract. And he argues that they are entitled to make a fair profit, apparently. He said that when conflicts occur, he deals with them on a case-by-case basis. So this was his sort of defense of the allegations from Senator Blake.
So, you know, we looked at this as like basically a tax on student life. And so one of our first events was that we mobilized all of the clubs and all of the associations to do a civil disobedience action on the mezzanine. And we called it the cheese-in. So they were all set up there with cheese and different things that they had bought, not from Marriott Sodexo.
Okay.
And we had our slogan was cheese-in, Marriott out.
Amazing.
And this campaign and this event was a huge success because there wasn't a single student group on campus that wasn't directly affected by this. And they were all, I think, very much on board to try to sort out that problem. We were making demands and we wanted to see that exclusivity agreement broken.
The exclusivity contract held by Sodexo and Marriott was so extreme, it meant that if students wanted to run, say, a bake sale, they couldn't even bring home-baked goods. They were forced to sell the overpriced products of Sodexo and Marriott. And similarly, the then burgeoning soup kitchen project of People's Potato was not permitted to serve their pay what you can food on campus without violating this exclusivity contract. The CSU also wanted the university to make a more appropriate food service provider than Sodexo Marriott, given alleged claims that they have stakes in the American private prison industry. According to Sodexo themselves, while they do operate several detention centers in the UK, they do not have any contracts with correctional facilities, public or private, in the US. But they have been accused of neglect, abuse, and systemic failures resulting in the inhumane treatment of prisoners in the UK.
We won, I guess, not fully all of our demands, but for example, they did agree to renegotiate their agreement with Marriott Sodexo so that it doesn't apply to student groups anymore. So that was a clear victory. Mm-hmm. And the administration fee, we succeeded in having the final increases that had been planned in the years going forward would not go forward. This basically meant, I think, collectively saving the students of Concordia about $1 million a year. And one other thing I'll just mention, we had also, as the student union, been approached by a group of activists who wanted to start up a free vegan lunch program at Concordia. This became the People's Potato. And so we made a decision that we were going to put our full institutional support behind the People's Potato.
So the majority of Canadian universities obviously receive government funding in addition to the tuition fees paid by students and increasingly private donations. So this contract with Marriott Sodexo was just one of many sort of increasingly corporate contracts that the university was relying on at this time to make ends meet. So we see austerity obviously creeping up and to the levels that it is today. And people like Rob Green and other people who were engaged in the struggle against this private interest saw the involvement of corporations on campus as a threat to the public nature of the university and a threat to what makes the university really able to serve public interests. And Green, for example, highlights that some corporate investments on campus have actually led to the silencing of student research and student activism, in particular when what the research is pointing to is seen as threatening to the profits of these corporations. So there's basically just a worry that contracts with Marriott and Zoom Media are setting a precedent to have more and more kind of say from big business into what students are learning, what research is being published, how activism is, you know, repressed or not at Concordia.
Yeah, and we see strong parallels today in the university's response to student protests, especially those in solidarity with Palestine and Gaza. As we're recording this on November 21st, students are striking to demand that Concordia end its employment partnerships with Lockheed Martin, CAE, Pratt & Whitney, Airbus, and Bombardier. These companies are all identified as exporting weapons, aircraft, and military training technology to Israel. Additional demands of the strike are that Concordia disclose the university's full investments portfolio to its students and cut all ties with Israel, according to Students for Palestine's Honor and Resistance, or SPHR, Concordia, which was founded in 1999. So while all of this is going on.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting link that you're pointing out there, that SPHR was actually founded and emerged in Concordia in 1999. And actually this year, they cut ties with Concordia. They became an independent club funded solely through community donations. And I suppose not actually taking fee levies. So maybe that gives them a certain level of independence with respect to what they have to answer to in terms of the administration. It's interesting to see the parallels there over the last 25 years of how Palestine, big business, student activism, and like the administration kind of creeping up its ties with big business are all not really separate or distinct from each other.
Absolutely.
In the year following accreditation and the strike, Rob Green is reelected Concordia Student Union president for a second term, and he wins by a landslide, which really points to the success of the referendum items and the sort of galvanization of a certain energy in the student body. And this is only the second time in recent memory that a student president has been reelected to a second term. So all the referenda that were on the ballot passed. These included, for example, a 15-cent per credit levy to support student media and a proposal that 85% of advertising space controlled by Zoom Media be allocated to the student union or the university's contract with Zoom be canceled. Additionally, it included a 5-cent per credit levy for the People's Potato Soup Kitchen, as well as the university providing kitchen space in the hall building. Originally, the People's Potato lacked a permanent space and cooked out of the basement of Reggie's, which is the Sir George Williams student bar.
At a certain point, we also took to referendum an independent fee levy that would go to the People's Potato Collective, who I just have to say were an incredible group of hardworking activists that really had a vision for what they wanted to do and the work ethic to make it happen. So, you know, from our perspective, these were exactly the kinds of people that we wanted to work with and that we wanted to support. And, you know, that was also something that put wind in our sails in terms of gaining support from members of the student community.
It's interesting. There's a sort of direct filling of the gap once there's a pushback against Marriott, Sodexo, and the emergence of People's Potato to have more food sovereignty and affordable, accessible food on campus.
Yeah, totally. And I ate at People's Potato almost every day during my undergrad. Shout out People's Potato. So in 2001, Rob Green steps down from the position that, for all intents and purposes, holds a lot more power at that moment than it did when he first took over as CSU president in 1999. After gaining accreditation in the referendum, the CSU then legally represents all students at Concordia and as such has an immense responsibility to fill to its then 25,000 constituents. The election marking the end of Green's CSU presidency also involved 15 referendum questions, including what you just mentioned, Sydney, this proposal to assure the survival of programs such as the People's Potato.
In no way am I taking personal credit for this. This was really all about the incredible team of activists that were involved in the student union at that time and those like the activists in the People's Potato Collective that worked with us to really build a vision of a student union that was going to fight for students' interests and try to win concrete victories that would, you know, improve the material conditions of students on campus and hopefully sort of open people's eyes to the possibilities of what student activism can achieve in terms of transforming that institution for the better in terms of, you know, reflecting a vision of a truly public institution.
So Green and obviously the others that voted on these referenda believe that student-run co-ops are the ideal model for on-campus business, which ensure that profits go directly back into the community. Green also emphasizes the importance of programs like People's Potato and Frigo Vert to help tackle student poverty and food insecurity. This is, once again, today hyper-relevant as the cost of living soars, and Canadian doctors warn that cases of scurvy actually are on the rise.
Yeah, so it's 2024, and the issue of student food on campus is alive and well. As of 2022, which is the most recent data I could find, the People's Potato fee levy is only 46 cents per credit for undergraduate students and $2.51 per semester for graduate students. And students can opt out of that during the opt-out periods. The November 19th, 2024 issue of The Link details a current campaign known as Fed Up. Fed Up Concordia is a new group on campus formed by students frustrated with the quality and ethics of the food served at the university. Their goal is to move away from corporate food ownership at Concordia and switch to student-led initiatives. So we see, again, the same push, the same desire for students to decorporatize, especially food on campus, but campus in general.
My name is Shyam Raghavan. I use he, him pronouns. So the Fed Up campaign is all about transforming the food system that we have at Concordia, especially Concordia's contract with Aramark, which is a multinational conglomerate that is known for exploiting prison labor and serving food that is subpar, sub-quality. Students at Residence have often reported food that is moldy, raw, and simply inedible.
The advocacy group had presented its referendum questions on food sovereignty at a CSU council meeting this past September, and if the referendum passes, FedUp's measures will be included in the CSU's official positions book, and they call for three specific goals.
So my name is Mia Kennedy, and I use she, her pronouns. And the referendum question is in three parts. The first one is trying to end exclusive contracts with multinational corporations on campus. So essentially not allowing corporations like Aramark to be the only ones able to serve food. The second one would be to support, enhance, and incubate local food initiatives. So that would include developing an alternative to Aramark, in addition to supporting other organizations on campus like Frigo Vert, People's Potato, the Hive Cafe. And lastly, asking Concordia to implement a holistic food policy that includes strong commitments to social and environmental justice. So these are all values that already most students align with, and it's really important to get this passed because that way the Concordia Student Union, who's already really supportive of this, they're further empowered to advocate for these things when they're talking with the admin.
The food advocacy group, Fed Up, doesn't want the university to sign any future contracts with other multinational corporations once its current contract expires in 2026. So the goal here is really to not continue bouncing from one major food corporation to the next, but to just get clear of that altogether.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
I spoke with Patrice Blay, who presided over the CSU accreditation in October 2000. Patrice also formerly served as VP of Finance and later as interim CSU president in 2001 to 2002.
My name is Patrice Blay. I'm a faculty member at Concordia today. But back in the days, in 99 and 2000, I was a student in political science, and I started to be involved with the Concordia Student Union. The first thing I did was that I acted as the vice president of the first accreditation drive. The one that did not succeed. And the second one, I was the president of the accreditation drive, and that was the one that did succeed in 2000.
Would you like to speak a little to like what you think was different between the first and second accreditation drive and what helped the second actually be successful?
Well, in order for an accreditation drive to succeed, you need to achieve two milestones. One is that you need, of course, more students to vote yes than no. And you also need the amount of yes votes to be 25% of the entire student body. For a big association like the Concordia Student Union, you need a huge turnout and you need a resource. In the first campaign, the resources that were allocated to the campaign were insufficient. And people did not realize that until it was too late. The second time around, when it was Rob Green, who was the president at the time, and said, Patrice, can you do this? I said, I can do it. But I put my conditions in terms of resources. I say, give me this, this, and this, and then we'll make it work.
What kinds of resources do you think helped it work?
So first of all, we took more time in terms, we're not looking at online yet. We're still in the early 2000s. So lots and lots of polling clerks. And also one thing that the ministry allows is what's called mobile polling. So you get with the permission of the university that your staff can go in and poll in classroom and move your polling from classroom to classroom. This is the key to succeed in accreditation. This model, and after, you know, either as a legal counsel or as a consultant, I mean, I've helped accredit about probably around 15 student association. And it's a strategy that has devised, that has always worked in terms of turnout. But you need a resource to do your mobile polling, very good inventory of where all the classes are, a good speech, a good training, so that your team comes and blitz. You send your polling clerks in teams of two. One distributes, one makes the speech. By the time they're done distributing, the speech is done. Then they go, they collect, they get out of there. They go to the next one.
And so accreditation did pass under the Rob Green presidency, as you said, and then you went on to be president of the CSU. Was it immediately following Rob Green?
So what happened is that I had two roles within the Concordia Student Union. I was also the chair of the student council. I never really planned to be an executive. For me, the accreditation drive and chairing council, it was what I liked to do. I liked procedures, and but I was known, I think, as someone who was like, say, reliable. So when the fraud occurred as the chair of council, people asked me to be a signing officer and to make sure that things were kind of okay.
Patrice is referring here to former Vice President Cheryl Navidad, who defrauded nearly $200,000 from the CSU.
Well, the VP Finance, of course, you know, had to resign. The whole finances were a mess. I was learning on the job, and I realized that, well, being a signing officer means that there's no financial infrastructures. There was no computer records. So I had to get into it. I was basically, the chair of council became kind of the de facto VP Finance. And then the following year, I ran for office as VP Finance as part of the Access slate with Sabrina Steele, who was the president. And then she resigned in October of that year. And that's when I became president. And then I was president until the end of that year, which finished 2002. Of course, it was difficult because in terms of the student body, that whole Cheryl Navidad episode, it impacted the credibility of the entire executive, even though it was one person who committed a criminal act. Nobody else was involved or was even accused of, but it had an impact.
Under your presidency, the CSU first passed their fee levy for a student center, and it seems that it took a really long time for the student center to actually come to fruition. Is that something you can speak to?
The student center discussions was part of it for years. Same thing that there was called, it was called the Master Space Agreement. This was negotiations between administration, even before Rob Green, David Smaller, Rob Green, even Sabrina. Like, it was going nowhere because you're dealing with the administrations, but the administration has all the cards. And if you push them too much, strategy with student association is wait, there's another election, somebody else will come in. Common tactic, delay, delay, delay. If you don't like what's going on, try it with the next team. So the idea of the student center is to say, if you want, you have to be more of an equal partner. So let's get a fund. And when you deal with the university, bring a few million dollars to the table. Then you're a stakeholder, then you'll be a financial partner. It will change the negotiating power of the student union. So we did. I still look from more afar. I was not involved after that, but I mean, they bought a building. Eduardo Maloney and his team at the end, they haven't done much with the building yet. But the real goal of that was just to create a negotiating power with the university. It took a long time, but eventually it reached its objectives.
Are there any other comments you'd like to make before we wrap up?
Well, I mean, thank you for bringing this event. It's not something that I thought necessarily that people would look back at as a key event. I can tell you the accreditation, what it did also, because at the time, while the CSU was representing all students and every student would vote, there was no unified funding. And this accreditation really gave a credibility. I can tell you that after the Cheryl Navidad, the CSU, who had no student fund, who had no contingency, they were broke, literally broke, in deficit. It required a lot of creative ideas to avoid either an almost shutdown of the operations or a bankruptcy. And bankruptcy was on the table, saying, you know what, then we'll start with another name. There's one thing that pushed the balance in order of saying, no, we're going to continue, is that right now it's accredited. And if we go bankruptcy and we restart, we're going to have to redo this. And who knows how many years it's going to take. You know, it's worth it. It's going to be a year or two of trouble. But in the end, and then I believe in retrospect, it was the right decision because the CSU offers even today to student activisms, and we've seen all kinds, lots of incredible resources, you know, to change the world because students are part of that.
Totally. Well, thank you so much, Patrice, for taking the time to speak with me today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
So basically, I oversee the campaigns department, which is the socio-political arm of the student union.
You're hearing from Juliana Smith, current campaigns coordinator for the Concordia Student Union.
So we are beholden to the CSU's positions book, which is a set of positions that students have voted on and adopted. Basically, it's a bunch of different things that students have said, like, hey, we care about this, and we believe it's in the political interest of the CSU to take action on these things. So my responsibility is to oversee the people that work in the department and help make sure that the CSU is working on all of these issues. And it spans a lot of different things. So my job looks like a lot of different things, depending on where the energy of student mobilization is at the time.
Our episode really focuses on the CSU accreditation drive that took place in 1999 and 2000. Are you familiar with the CSU accreditation drive? And if so, are there any like clear through lines, repercussions, legacy that you can point to from that in how the CSU operates today?
We do have this really wide base of institutional knowledge that students have continued to share with one another and have proven to be such an amazing resource in supporting students today. So I think that's kind of where I think back to, like, maybe that accreditation drive is 25 years ago and I don't particularly know about it, but there's like in the shared memory of the student body, like there's definitely echoes of those spirits of resilience in today's movement as well.
One thing we've seen in our research is just this ongoing issue with voter turnout and actually getting Concordia students to participate in their student government. Is that something you can speak to at all?
Yeah, I know it's definitely something I struggle with. I was a CSU exec in 2022, 2023. Yeah, and I know the topic of elections was definitely like an issue. And even just for like the CSU has to hold an annual general meeting. And we had a quorum of 30 people who had to attend and we like couldn't hit quorum for that meeting. And I think there's like a lot of factors. And I've thought a lot over the last couple of years about student engagement, specifically when it comes to student politics. And I think it's interesting because, you know, my staff tables on a weekly basis and is like on the ground, just this open platform to talk to students and to like engage them in whatever they want to talk about. And so students are talking about a lot of the things that the CSU is working on and campaigning on. But then when it comes to actually taking that next step to getting involved, it's something that we really struggle with. And I think it comes down to a couple different things. Like the way that I was kind of indoctrinated into the CSU was really seeing the CSU for what it is, which is a union. And so because of that, modeling the way we run the CSU after a labor union and looking at those tactics and finding ways to kind of adapt them and utilize them within this localized setting, because I think that is one of the greatest strengths of a student union is like we're on a university campus. Everyone is here and you kind of have a captive audience. So why is it so hard to captivate them? And I think part of that is because people struggle with having the way they're doing outreach actually be effective, because it's one thing to be on campus and to have a visible presence, but students are busy. Like, I think there's probably students listening to this that are going to be like, yeah, I don't have time. I have a job. I have classes. I have friends. Like, just being a student and not being involved in student politics is already asking a lot of an individual. That's one thing. But even when it comes to just something as simple as voting, I don't think the outreach that people are doing is actually effective. Like, it's one thing to have a visible presence, but to actually like step out from behind the table and try to talk to someone and like find a way to have a conversation with them and to show them that the thing that they care about is also something you care about. And here's why, and here's what you're going to do about it. There's a lot of things within the university that are not transparent and people don't know about it until it's too late. And I think there's more that could be done to help activate people and like show them, hey, this is happening right under your nose. Isn't this so frustrating? And that's something that I've thought a lot about this year. Like, I really, if I had one goal for the year, is to like help make all of these super untransparent structures more transparent to students, because the university governance system is a hot mess, and it's a hot mess on purpose. Like, they make it untransparent so that students can't contest what's going on. And I've done a lot of work over the last couple of months working with some really cool faculty members, and we've been able to put on a couple workshops where we're exposing all of this and explaining it to students. Like, this is how the university works, and now here is how you find the person that you should be mad with, because that person has a name and they have an email address that you could be reaching out to right now.
Incredible. Yeah, that's awesome work. I'm glad to hear that you're doing. Before I let you go, I'll just ask if there's anything else you want to say about like the CSU, why it's important, what it does for students.
I mean, I think the CSU is one of the most underutilized resources within the university, like for students. We represent every single undergraduate student at this university. And by doing that, you know, we have access to a lot of resources. We have access to a lot of knowledge. And I think it's really important for people to recognize that and to hold the CSU responsible for the things that it should be doing. Part of the reason why elections keep getting bungled is that the CSU, as much as I love it, is really struggling and needs motivated people to get involved. That's like the biggest thing that I can't stress enough. The CSU can't function without student involvement. So if anyone's interested in getting involved at the CSU, like reach out to campaigns and I can give you a whole rundown. As a staff member and also as a past executive, I have a really good understanding of like all of the different aspects of how the CSU works. And it's taken me a long time to like accumulate that knowledge, and I'm more than happy to share that with people.
Incredible. Well, thank you so much, Juliana.
Yeah, no problem.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
One thing I found interesting that came out of like accreditation, collecting this fee, establishing a student center, all these methods to give students some actual like bargaining power against the university. And so that to me is, I think, one of the really interesting things that's come out of our research in this episode, looking at accreditation and protest and whatever, is just like all students just fighting to have their say in their own university. And it's kind of wild to me that it's so hard for students to have a say when they are the lifeblood of the university.
Yeah, I think I talked to someone who does research on student labor movements and labor movements in Quebec. And he talked about how the sort of union membership you enter into as soon as you pay tuition at a university, your sort of automatic membership as part of a student union, is kind of different than, you know, when you sign an employment contract, because in order to disrupt the sort of day-to-day goings on of the business, I guess, normally when you're an employee, you stop going to work. Like the postal workers on strike now, like that is disrupting the sort of the wheels that make the business turn. But as a student, when you're disrupting the activities of the university, it's more complicated because there's also other people who are trying to go to class. And so, you know, picketing outside a classroom is not just necessarily throwing a wrench into the wheels of the administration. It's also because it's not so obvious that a university is just for profit. Like, obviously, universities are for profit and increasingly so. But there's this sort of tricky business of people still trying to go to class and kind of get their degree over with. And where do they fit in terms of being in solidarity with their fellow classmates, but also trying to access an education that isn't actually super accessible and that they're paying for and not getting paid for. It's kind of hard, I think, to get students to like recognize, I guess, what it means to be in solidarity with each other, because people have such different orientations to like education and their participation in the institution and what that actually means for them. Like, is it just a stopover on the way to a job?
I think it's hard for students to recognize that they have power, one, and to even think about like the university or administration as like a body that they can negotiate with or push back against. It does feel very, well, this is the university, this is how it works. I just go here. Exactly, like I'm going to put in my 4 or so years and move on with the rest of my like quote unquote real life. It's interesting too, like one of my, I was talking to a friend who participated in the strike last week, and she was saying how sometimes teachers or professors will kind of take it personally when students strike and don't attend their class that's held during a strike. So there's another like strange tension where it's like there's the administration, there's students, and then there's also instructors and professors.
Yeah, and I mean the what's a shame about that, besides, not being in solidarity with students, is that often, those faculty members, that it's from a lack of understanding that they are just as exploited, if not more so, by the university than students. As students are, or like grad students, postdocs, those kind of more precarious positions within university, if you're like a part-time faculty member, which is, increasingly the way things are going, just, contracts, limited term appointments, part-time faculty, less tenured members. And, they're obviously exploited by not just the administration, but just by the precarity of the jobs that are available, the like lower pay, not having a lot of power, and that they are actually have a lot more in common, I guess, with the students most of the time than with the body that they are defending when they take things personally or cross picket lines or whatever it is.
Yeah, I would say instructors definitely have more in common with students than the university and less power, I think, than the students to mobilize against these like systems, these unjust systems.
They need them to live also. Maybe that'll come up in later episodes, but yeah, looking specifically at some of the like little coalitions that are made between teachers and students, and some of the, I guess 2012 is a good example of that.
Yeah, I think a lot of teachers got involved, right?
And in Palestine too, like I boycotting and just speaking at different events and being involved as like supports for students.
Yeah, totally. A lot of the profs that I know are involved in like Profs for Palestine.
It'll be interesting to like explore that a little bit more later. Thank you to Robert Green, Juliana Smith, and Patrice Blay for their interviews. Adam Innes for providing interview clips with Fed Up Concordia members Mia and Shyam. Our volunteers Onyx, Bridget, and Charlie for their work on this episode, and to the CRFC Radiometers program for funding Discordia.
Protest soundbites were recorded at Concordia University on November 21st, 2024, and you can look forward to hearing more about that in future episodes. Contact us at discordia@cjlo.com with questions or to get involved. You can find this episode in the archives at cjlo.com, SoundCloud, and on Spotify.
Tune in the new year for the third episode of Discordia on Monday, January 13th at 6 p.m. on CJLO 1690 AM and cjlo.com. We'll be talking about the 2002 Netanyahu riot at Concordia.